This episode of The Writer and the Critic is recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. We're recording live at Continuum 7 in Melbourne.
Isn't that great?
It's awesome. I haven't introduced you yet.
Ah, great.
Okay. Sitting to my left, being very noisy, is my regular podcasting cohort, Mr. Ian Mond. Say hello, Ian.
Hello, wide audience world. How are you? Hi, Jason. I just wanted to point out, Jason, this is your husband, Jason.
Yes.
You're aware of him?
I'm vaguely aware of him.
I think it's wonderful that he's come to listen to this podcast. He's very first Writer and the Critic.
He's here every month.
Yeah, but he's hiding behind the door when...
Very true.
Yeah.
Anyway, quiet now. On my far left is our special guest for this podcast, also the guest of honour for the Continuum Convention, Miss Catherine Valenti.
Hi.
How are you, Kat?
I'm pretty good.
How have you been finding the convention?
It's fantastic, although exhausting.
And it's only Sunday night.
Well, it turns out that they throw a mean dance party here. So
they do.
I was up past my bedtime last night.
You were really taking that dance floor apart. In a good way. No, not like actually.
So Twitter tells me.
Yeah. Oh, was it on Twitter?
No, a couple of people tweeted that I was burning up the dance floor.
Yeah, cutting the rug the whole lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were great. No, you really got into it.
I have it on very good authority that last year they broke the dance floor.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, but Kat didn't. She was great. She was very light on her feet.
Yes, no. Yeah. I think it's just an indication of a very good mask ball when they break the dance floor.
So it was your version of Eileen that got played.
Well, not. I mean, it's Dexy Midnight Runner's version, as far as I know. But I don't have a cover of it or anything. But I certainly went and got it on my computer on a USB drive and brought it down.
You should have seen it. You weren't there for that bit when it played. It just went crazy. Broadway style, a whole lot. It was very good. No, it was great. Anyway, enough of that.
I think we'll just do a brief introduction for the future people who are listening later on who are not at Continuum and may not know all about the wonderful Kat that we've gotten to get to know over the past 3 days. So, Kat, would you like to introduce yourself very briefly, apart from the fact, of course, that you are a New York Times best-selling author?
Yes, as of a couple of weeks ago. I write fantasy novels. My most recent novel for adults is Deathless, which is a retelling of a Russian fairy tale set during the Stalinist era. My most recent YA, and my first YA, is The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, which is what was on the New York Times list. And before that, The Orphan's Tales and Palimpsest were my most well-known novels. Palimpsest was nominated for the Hugo and won the Lambda Award. The Orphan's Tales won the Tiptree Award and the Mythopoeic Award. Fairyland won the Andre Norton Award, which was the first time that a crowdfunded novel had won a literary award before it came out. So,
awesome.
Yeah. Like Merlin, I like to do it backwards.
I forgot you won a Tiptree.
I did. It was my first award, actually.
Really?
Yeah. I was it was barely 27.
We hate you.
Oh, I don't. No, I don't hate you. I think that's really great.
That's because you don't win awards.
Oh, God. Really? Why?
Oh, it's what I do.
So what did you win on Friday night, Kirsten? What did you win? Why don't you tell everyone?
I won a Kronos Award for my novel, Madig and Mine, and we did not win a Kronos Award for this podcast.
I was very sad that you guys didn't win. The Kronos Award is so pretty.
It's very pretty.
I was devastated. I really do think there was some block voting involved.
We did 3 episodes last year.
It was 2, wasn't it?
2. See, that's not worthy of an award. Next year. We'll get them next year.
No, it might have been 3. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So, Kat, I wanted to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You're very opinionated.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I
had a whole carry-on bag to bring my opinions over to Australia.
And obviously, as a woman, that's quite strange. So I wanted to get a sexist comment in earlier. Did you see what I did there? Can you not look at the...
Oh, you're so unprofessional. Just keep going.
Thanks. Anywho, so I read your
blog. It works better if you just own the sexist comments.
Oh, okay.
You don't backpedal.
Yeah, thanks. So anyway, I read your live journal where you're very outspoken. Do you feel that's going to have to change now, being a New York Times bestselling author?
Well, I've been blogging for 10 years and it hasn't changed yet, so I doubt it. I mean, yes, I'm opinionated on the internet. So are we all. That I'm a woman, that I'm young has always made that kind of an awkward thing from time to time. But mostly I get away with it because I've always done it, even before I had book contracts, before I was publishing. It was no different online then than I am now. It's actually probably bitchier after I started knowing how the publishing industry worked.
You say you got worse.
Probably. I'm more cynical.
Okay.
But I know that what we're heading toward here is the whole negative reviews thing.
How would you know that? Oh, you've read the talking points. See, I told you not to show it to her.
Because I have savaged a few books on my LiveJournal. Like, nobody minds if I crap on the ending of Lost or I take on people who are sexist and racist online. They all love it when they can aim me like a gun. But when I aim at something that they like, then suddenly I'm shocking, and it's as though I'm this person they've never met before. But I'm an equal opportunity Gatling gun.
But you have eviscerated some books. I mean, seriously.
I have, and I feel kind of bad about it now. The thing is that because I have been blogging long before I was a writer, I forget sometimes that it's not like when I had 30 readers.
Yeah.
Everybody has Google alerts, and like many, many, many people read my blog, and possibly my first fire hose of reaction to a book is not appropriate. But at the same time, I mean, I still feel the way I do about Yellow Blue Tibia, and I mean, I'm not sorry I said it. I'm not sorry I said what I said about steampunk. I probably could have said that in a nicer way, but it was honest, and I think that honesty is something that we could use online rather than guarding every opinion against what everybody might think of it. I think when books are bad that we should point out that they are bad. I think that's sort of the whole point of criticism. Also, I mean, I do tend to go for the comedic factor, which
you're very
is
funny.
I'm glad. I don't think Adam Roberts thinks I'm funny. He's the author of Yellow Blue Tibia. It's probably the worst I've ever been to a book, I think.
Yeah, well, he was very good in that he didn't. I don't think he actually responded in the live journal.
Oh,
itself.
Yes, he did.
Did he?
Yes.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, yeah. We had a whole little conversation.
Oh. Was it polite?
It was, you know, I was actually quite impressed. It was polite. And, yeah, I mean, he disagreed, obviously, with what I was saying. We had a conversation about the portrayal of the fat character, the American fat character.
Oh, no,
it's more
read.
Or less the same. American equals fat. And he did not feel that that was a problem, and I expressed that I did feel it was, and he said he would have to think about it, and that's the last I heard from him. I do think commenting is no, you don't do that. People say bad things about my books all the time. I do not comment as much
you've
as I might
never,
want to sometimes.
You've never commented on a negative review?
I have never commented on a negative review.
Okay.
It's not cool. It's not done. It's not what you do.
Like, have you anonymously, not you anonymous, but have you mentioned a line from a review without saying where it was from, who it was, just to
Occasionally on Twitter, but I actually usually will only do that for like a newspaper review or an Amazon review or something. I don't tend to
like to
send people to a blog like that. That feels hostile and aggressive. But like my hometown newspaper reviewed Deathless a couple of weeks ago and just basically dismissed it because it was fantasy. I mean, it was a certified content-free review. They said it's fantasy, therefore ridiculous. It's as bizarre as reading Harry Potter as an adult.
That's terrible.
Okay.
Who does
Thank
that?
You. And I linked to it on Twitter because it just seems so ridiculous to me. Like why did you even bother reviewing that book if you had no interest in the genre and thought that the genre on the face of it was ridiculous?
Yeah.
Then what's the point? But I also feel that since he's employed as a book reviewer by the Portland Press Herald, that's fair game. Occasionally, Palimpsest, when it was nominated for the Hugo, fell into the hands of a lot of people who probably wouldn't have read it otherwise. And I actually can't read reviews of Palimpsest anymore because they got very angry at that book and said some very upsetting things.
What, because there's sex in it?
There's sex and poetry in it, and that tends to bother a certain segment of science fiction readers. One as much as the other?
Well, first...
Not by poetry, I don't mean like in a column rhyming poetry. I mean like it's poetic language
There's
screwing. But yeah, there's all kinds of Amazon reviews about how I'm sexually disturbed, and they're lovely little straw man reviews that somehow have to be about me personally rather than the book. But I do not respond to it because it is not appropriate.
I would have thought
I just stopped reading. I can't even read positive reviews of it anymore. I just can't. I
I would have thought any book that has lots of lesbian sex in it would do, go very well.
So there's a lot of gay male sex in it too, though, and that, yeah, that tends to put that same section of science fiction readers right off.
But these were just silly Amazon people who were just reading it as a...
I don't actually think that Amazon reviews are silly, but...
No, not all of them, but these are like the sort of badly spelled four sentences.
No.
Oh, okay,
no,
they were actual rants.
Yeah, that's it was Hugo voters that hated it the most.
Yeah, and I was going to say, so it was the issue with the Hugo that it wasn't overt science fiction, that whole chestnut.
I just think that, I mean... I don't think that that particular the enthusiastic Hugo voter section of the science fiction reading community had really read my books before, and so they came at Palimpsest, which is not my most accessible book to begin with. It is full of alternative sexuality and some really weird stuff, and it's written in a very poetic style that is not really conformed to the transparent prose thing. It's no different than what I've done before, but this particular portion of the populace would never have picked up the book on their own. These reviews are all I'm reviewing all the Hugo books.
Yeah, okay.
So this is when I got to her. And so it just got very upsetting, and I stopped being able to read reviews of that book. But I think that just don't read reviews of that book is better than get angry at somebody because they didn't like your book, or even worse, get sad at them in the comments because they didn't like the book. That's really hard. Like I do feel that it's the duty of a critic to point out when a book is not good. You know, otherwise, how do we know what's good? How does anybody know what's good? And we all disagree on things. People love Yellow Blue Tibia. They really do. I do not love it. But I felt that I had an angle on it that nobody had not seen it mentioned before, and so I talked about it. I don't really know how to filter when it comes to my blog and online. Like, I never have, so I'm not good at it. I've built my blog audience by being brutally honest. And
okay, so what about the... do you have any questions, by the way? Because I'm just...
No, keep going.
Okay, so what about the whole idea that the professional writer as critic, who's... You're all now part of... You're all in the secret professional writers club.
Yes.
And you're all meant to be friends with
Tuesdays.
Each other. You meet Tuesdays. And you're meant to be friends with each other and pat each other on the back and never, ever, ever say a bad thing about anyone, ever. I mean, that's just bullshit.
That's what the memo says.
Yeah.
So actually, a couple of months ago, I tweeted that I'm not doing negative reviews anymore. Because I posted a review to my live stream. It wasn't even a review. That's the thing about it. It wasn't even a review. It was a comment on a book that I had not even yet finished. But I said it's a really beautifully written book, and it's really interesting, and I've never really seen someone try to put together fiction and nonfiction this way before, and it's really cool. And there's just this one thing that makes me sad and bothers me. And I wish that Russians, when portrayed by Western writers, did not always end up in this particular peg. And the author left a comment and was all sad about it. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't even say it's brilliant except for this one thing without the author being, that makes me a sad panda. You know? I don't want to hurt people's feelings. It's not about... many of them are my friends, many authors... I know a lot of them, and I don't want to hurt feelings, and I don't want people to be sad pandas because of something I said. And I am a picky reader. I am a much pickier reader than most people. So I decided that I would no longer savage books on my live drum.
And yet you're on this show. Interesting. So I'm assuming the three books that will... This is actually not a bad segue into the books themselves.
It's not a bad segue at all.
I'm assuming, of course, the three books that we're going to look at, you're going to be delightful about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, what we'll do is we'll just say that you're on holiday from the club and you're... Oh, this is your one last
guy.
Well,
no, we're in Australia.
Correct.
Except when you broadcast it on the internet.
Yeah, correct. Well, we're not broadcasting. This is just for this audience.
Yeah,
this is a special...
No, these microphones aren't plugged into anything. It's fine.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Don't worry. We'll treat you nice. Do we want to? Do you think we've interrogated enough? I had other questions,
but I do want to say. It's not because I the whole I don't want to do negative reviews anymore. It's not because we're all in our secret clubhouse and the memo went around that everybody should be nice to each other. Like we're not all that nice to each other. People do post negative reviews, and there's been many internet debates on whether negative reviews should even be allowed in some sort of cosmic sense. It's because I don't want to cause emotional damage to people, and I don't want to deal with the emotional damage that causes me, because I feel bad for people. I don't want to have empathy with the people that I review, and I do. So it's too much trauma for me.
You a sad panda.
It makes me a sad panda. I don't want them to be sad.
Rose Fox wrote a few days ago about candor in reviews in her Publisher Weekly blog, which was basically to say, stuff the sand pandas, get over yourselves.
Yeah, but Rose Fox is a professional reviewer. And if all I were doing were reviewing things professionally, I would absolutely be in. I don't want to be dishonest. Like, if people ask me in person what I thought of a book, the fire hose will turn on, no problem. I just don't want to post it where Google knows where it is to tell the people that I didn't like their book. Like, it makes WorldCon awkward. but I mean, that's what Rose does, and she's absolutely right, and I do believe that that reviewers should be brutally honest.
Yeah, but she also mentioned this thing about the friends. Like, if it's your friend and you're reviewing the book for them, and the friend says, and you do it negatively, and the friend goes, I don't want to be friends with you anymore, then they weren't very much on the friend scale to begin with. I mean, we should get over that whole friendship bullshit.
Rose is a dear friend of mine, and I think that she underestimates how personally attached we all are to our books. When your friend doesn't like your book and tells all their friends that it was terrible and that your book was bad and you should feel bad, it is hard to be like, hey, well, we'll go out for drinks, you know? Not everybody can just let that roll off. Some people can, but not everyone can. I think that if other people want to do it, that's fine, but I'm taking a break from...
Absolutely.
Well, I know that The Book Thief has been a subject because
I didn't mention
because
it
because I read it because of you guys and was deeply disturbed by it. But he's not my friend, so I felt okay.
Marcus Zusak.
Yeah, that, I don't know that guy.
Yeah, so, I know, but you upset me though, because here I am a Jew.
Also, it's a big enough book that it doesn't matter what I think. Like, it's okay to talk about Lost, it's okay to talk about Stephen King and all of these authors that are, you know, cultural benchmarks. You can break those, that's fine. It's hard when someone's a sort of indie or mid-list writer where a review can actually seriously damage the number of books that they sell. It's harder for me to do that to a friend.
Listen to our second podcast where we spend about 45 minutes talking about your thoughts on the book. It's all there. Now, before we start with the books, we should probably mention... spoilers situation, because I don't read the books.
Well, for people who might be here, or people again who might be listening at home, we spoil books. Sorry. We're going to assume you've either read the books or you don't much care if you hear about major plot points or endings or so on. We don't go through a page by page, so you're not going to get everything. But I think especially possibly with Embassy Town.
Well, Embassy Town came out 4 weeks ago. How many people in this room have read it?
Okay.
Yeah, Christ, that's going to be good. Well, if you want it, they'll clean out the room.
So there will be...
How many people are concerned if we do provide majors? I suppose you could look. It's free choice. You can get up and go. I'm not going to stop you. So if it's really going to bother you, then as Kirsten said, we're not going to do a page by page analysis, but we are going to. The problem is that two of the books. So the Stephen King is novellas, but among others, and Embassy Town. For me, their endings are actually crucial to discussing the books. And without discussing the endings,
I think just, especially Embassy Town.
I don't know. That's the same with you.
I don't really think that you can review effectively without spoilers.
Okay.
Anything. Oh, well.
No one seems to be, you know, cutting their throats or anything, so... Good. All right. Well...
Okay. Well, we're going to start with the book I recommended for Ian, which is Stephen King's latest book, Full Dark, No Stars, which is a collection of, I think, two novellas and two short stories, really. Definitely one short story. They're not four novellas. This is not a different seasons or...
Although that's how it's been sold.
Or a four-part... Yeah, that's how thick the book is.
Yeah, no one...
It's not... the book is about an inch thick. This is not one of his big doorstopper four novella collections that he's released previously. And, you know, one of the works in there is just a short story. And the other three aren't anywhere near as long as things like Shawshank and The Body and so on. Yeah. I wouldn't think.
I just want to ask Kat something. Mm-hmm. We've got a back cover photo of Stephen King here, looking quite handsome with his jeans. Are you going to be doing back cover photos like this where, you know, you've got the whole hands in the pockets, grinning like that?
Am I going to look like Stephen King on the back cover?
Well, no.
Unlikely. I have books that have my picture on it already. Not a full back jacket like that, but, you know, I'm not as pretty as Stephen.
He is an odd-looking guy.
A bit.
That's not going to go down well, is it?
But, I mean, horror writers are not required to be...
beautiful.
Well, male horror writers, anyway.
That's another
writers
it is another issue. Yeah. And, I mean, I could get into the whole... I've talked about the gendering of author photos before. We don't need to...
Oh, with the... Yeah.
Yeah, but that's another one. Like, I'm confident in my casual masculinity, like...
So he's allowed to stick his hands in his pockets, whereas you have to upright your boobs or something.
Oh. I should have brought the stick.
No. Is that what you meant? The crossed arms?
No.
It's the male strongman.
To put their biceps out. Actually, that pose is not great for boobs. Like,
no.
It doesn't really work.
Doesn't it?
It squashes them. Yeah, look, I'm doing it right now. It squashes them down.
Fascinating.
Seriously, you've either got to go above or below.
Yeah, it's no good.
It doesn't work.
I say we practice it and see what happens.
Well, you're...
Yeah, I've got actually quite ample boobs.
Really.
You're right.
You go below.
It
you see, you go below.
Actually, it frames your cleavage quite nicely.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We can put a picture of that up on the website.
Yeah. My nipples enjoyed that too. So, the first novella... We're not going to... I mean, look.
We're not going to... Well, they're four novellas. So and the book, I think, is... possibly one of the best titles for a book I've seen in a long time. Because it is absolutely truth in labelling. This is a really, really dark book. Almost irredeemably dark, actually. And I've got to say, your gender does not come off well.
No, they don't. I do wonder why the British... trade paper's got stars on the cover when it's called Full Dark.
I know.
Stars.
Yeah.
And if it's not even dark.
I know.
And it's got corn
on it. Yeah. So. He wrote a book called Children of the Corn, a story called Children of the Corn, so they're probably going back to that.
Look, I love like you, and I think you as well, Catherine.
Okay, don't call me Catherine. Since when do you call me Catherine? Call me Cat.
I'm being quite formal now. We're doing critiquing. So... I've Stephen King. I realise that there's only three things of his that I haven't actually read, and one of those is Stephen King at the Movies. And in fact, I think I've read quite a few of that, quite a few of the articles in that as well. And the two things I haven't read are Cycle of the Wolf and The Eyes of the Thingamajig.
Dragon,
yeah. So I love Stephen. I love Stephen. You love Stephen?
Yes.
You love Stephen?
I love Stephen King.
I think, though, one of the comments you made that he's past his best, to me, all the rock...
Stick that right on my forehead.
Oh, no, I didn't say who said it.
Visually, yes, you did. You said the comment you made.
I didn't say which you. It could have been Kirsten.
I can add
up to what a shame.
Right out.
But anyway, so I didn't mean to do that. But I think all the writerly tricks that I didn't notice when I was 18 and 20 and 25, I'm now really noticing, such as the fact that every character in this has a voice in their head telling them what to do.
That's Stephen King, though.
Yeah, but, you know, it's getting on my tits now. And even when I push them up, I do the whole cleavage thing. So in 1922, which is the first novella, you've got the conniving man in the trigger rape story. There's a rape story called The Big Driver, and if rape does trigger you, you probably shouldn't read it. Because the rape scene is fucking brutal. There's the main character who is raped is her tom-tom talks to her and her cat talks to her, which is then also a voice in her head, correct?
Mm-hmm.
In the last story, the female protagonist in that, she has her...
A dark
side of her that talks to her.
The dark girl, the dark wife.
I know King's been doing this since, you know,
but I, don't,
forever.
Don't you, well...
But it just, I know, it just... I just thought variety.
Don't you have a voice in your head that talks to you?
The problem I've got is...
No, seriously, don't you have a voice in your head that talks to you?
Yes, it's talking to me now and it's telling me that I should... I won't say what it's saying I should do, but it's saying something bad. But the thing is that, yeah, I do, but it's a writerly tick that he's got. That's the point I'm trying to make.
It's a writerly tick, but it's possibly also more noticeable because it's... I think it something most people do. Most people have a voice in their head that talks to them. You're talking to yourself. I'm not talking about schizophrenia. You are talking to yourself. And, you know, I mean, Stephen King takes it to a more extreme where often his characters will name that voice as another personality that, so they're not really talking to themselves, even though they are.
If I was reading a full novel,
yeah,
it doesn't bother me as much because it's, you know, a 2,500 page novel, Under the Dome, whatever. It's a long book. But when it's four novellas and it's different characters and they all have the same tick, it gets on your tick.
Yeah, but I think it's a very common human thing. I think it's
But that doesn't work. So I know it's a common human thing. Understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. That when you have a collection and the same technique is being used in every story, like maybe you wouldn't notice it if this were a short story collection that had a lot of stories and they were variety, or if it was only two of the novellas that had it. But I mean that's sort of the magic of deciding what goes into a collection and what doesn't. You don't want things that all have the same technique because it becomes very obvious. Okay.
And this is an odd collection of I like all the stories. I think it's a very odd collection to have together.
So can I just – so you like the rape revenge story? I should give a bit of detail. There's a story – the only story that features an author in it.
That's my least favourite of the four.
It's called Big Driver. It's the second story. Basically and Kat, I – This will teach you some lessons here.
Okay.
Things that you shouldn't do. You shouldn't go out to small little towns which have small little bookstores.
Libraries.
And you shouldn't do a reading for them, which is a bit boring. And then you shouldn't then speak to the librarian and listen to her road directions to get home, because what she'll ultimately do is send you down a road where her rapist son is waiting for you to rape the shit out of you. That's likely what's going to happen. So that is the cautionary tale that comes out of Big Driver. And what you'll end up doing, and this is the real
that, wait, paper. That's what you got out of that story?
I haven't finished
messages
yet.
Messages for Kat. That's what you got out of that story.
No, and then Kat, what you shouldn't do is not ring the police. Because you're worried about what it'll look like for you, and instead go on a weird rape revenge thing where
I just post to my live journal.
Yeah, probably not something we should laugh about. But
I think that the way that my generation processes that stuff is different. And I would feel, if something like that happened to me, I would feel it would be necessary to talk about it, not be secretive.
Well, that's what.
So I'm not being flippant, is what I'm saying.
I'll let you get a word in, please. But no, curse I'm talking to here, audio people. There was something old-fashioned about the story. It was an old-fashioned take on rape revenge.
What was really interesting about this, and it is my least favourite in the collection, because it is kind of formulaic. But that in itself is a little disturbing that we have a story like this and we just go, another rape revenge story.
Oh, my God.
No, I'm serious, because it's...
Well, the horror genre uses rape a lot.
Yeah, and this is actually told from the point of view of the female character who... And the thought processes that go through her head, I thought they were really, really well done. And it's not just that she's a mid-list author, and the thought process that are kind of going through her head is, if I go to the police, if I report this, this is not going to be dealt with as a private person whose friends and family may know, and that's kind of where that ends. It's going to be dealt with as, now I'll always be known as the romance writer who got raped. And that's why she doesn't go to the police.
And you bought that?
Fuck yeah. Because I bought it for her, because she was... her character was like that.
I didn't buy it.
I think I bought that from her point of view.
And when a cat started talking to her, I definitely didn't buy it.
Fritzy the cat.
It's actually funny, because he does make it funny. The tom-tom says, you know, Tess, where do you want to go now? And then starts talking to her about how it can get revenge on the big fat guy who raped her, and the mum and the other one and the brother.
No, I think he drew her character really, really well. And she's an older generation of woman, and she lives alone. She doesn't really have a lot of support in her life. And you know, I thought it was kind of good. I actually don't think he needed to put the rape scene in there, just because we have so much cultural, I guess, images and scenes in our head. It's the rape scene wasn't. There was nothing out of the ordinary beyond the fact that it was quite a brutal rape. So you don't really need to describe it. It crossed very, very close to an exploitative sort of a scene, and you didn't need it. It's kind of enough to know. It's we're not back.
But he did it because he wanted to slap you in the face with it.
Yeah, but I don't think he had to put all the details in.
There's a,
but yeah, I mean, Stephen King has never met a detail he didn't like. I mean, that's
true.
Heavy description is kind of part of the deal.
Yeah, but
it does.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make very much sense to me that you don't want to be the romance writer who was raped, but you're cool being the romance writer who got revenge on your rapist. I mean,
oh well, she was. Well, she doesn't get, like, no one would know about that. So, yeah, so I mean that one's my least. I really like the last story. Actually, I thought the last story makes the collection. It's again a woman with a voice in her head.
A good marriage.
Yeah, but he wrote this because there was a serial killing case in the US, and the man had been killing girls for 30 odd years, and he'd been married the whole time, and his wife got lacerated in the media after he was caught, and nobody believed that she couldn't possibly have known something, and she must have been hiding it, and she must have been protecting him, and obviously she's as bad as him then, and which it's just ick. And so he's written this story from the point of view of a woman who is married to a guy who she finds out accidentally one day by finding something in the garage and putting some pieces together that he's actually this serial killer who's been operating around the place.
Which is, again, a cliched idea.
It's a cliche. Stephen King kind of, with very few exceptions, Stephen King only works with cliched ideas. Mm. It's what he does with them. It's his. You don't read Stephen King to go, oh, my God, that idea was amazing. It blew my mind.
That's not true. The Langoliers is like that. That was a really cool.
You read it for the characters and for the way they're done.
One of my favorite novels of all time is It, and the ideas in that are phenomenal.
Yeah, with some exceptions, but for the most part,
ideas in his novels are fresher. I think he plays with cliche more in his short stories. I think his novels often have become tropes of their own, especially when you talk about his early career.
Yeah. But that's it. You read Stephen King for the way the story's written, and for the way the characters are, and the way they interact, and
A Good Marriage does that very well.
And A Good Marriage does that phenomenally well. It's such a good story.
I mean, I thought the story was going to go in the direction of that she would somehow try and kill him, but not tell him, or which it sort of does go in the direction that I think about it. But basically, I didn't expect the husband to turn up 2 hours after she discovers this, because he can detect from her voice on the phone that there's something wrong, because they've been married for 27 years, and he's out in another town selling coins or whatever,
and possibly
raping and killing someone, and he's had a phone call to her, and she's just discovered all this, but she's tried to have a brave voice, and he's been able to detect that her voice isn't 100%, and so he's actually raced home to check his hidey hole, and then when he saw that the tape was broken, he then starts to discuss. See, what I thought would happen is that he'd try to kill her, and there'd be all this running around the house, scrabbling for kitchen knives.
But that's not what happens.
That's not what happens. Yeah, that was.
And it's nice.
There's no scrabbling for kitchen knives, Kat.
Good.
No, it's certainly one of his best shorter pieces. I really, really rate it.
It is good. I love Fair Extension, though. That is a hilarious story.
But it's an odd one. It almost doesn't quite fit.
Well, it doesn't fit at all in the collection.
Yeah. It's a really weird collection.
A guy meets the devil. The devil gives the guy.
The guy has cancer.
He's got cancer.
Terminal cancer.
And by the way, the devil is called, it's Elvid.
Something like that. And so the devil says, well, you know, I'll make you a deal and I'll Cure your cancer. I'll give you an extension on your life, basically. But there's a price, and it's kind of got to come away from someone else. And so the main character, what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Oh, whatever his
anyway,
name is.
Anyway, so the guy says, oh, well, yeah, there's my like neighbour who I've been friends with forever, but he's actually awful and I don't like him, so he can have like all my bad stuff. So this story turns around this neighbour who ends up being the guy who's been jealous of him, and the neighbour took his girlfriend, but not in a malicious way. It's just, you know, ended up with her, and he was really successful. He's got a good business, and our protagonist is his marriage is a little.
No, it's fine.
It's not on the rocks.
No, the marriage is fine.
It's not. There's nothing. It's kind of going
on. But it's basically about a story about a guy who is an asshole who has cancer, who then turns his cancer onto his friend who isn't a great guy.
Well, his friend doesn't get cancer. His friend gets
it's just bad luck.
It's the bad luck he turns onto.
And the brilliant part of the story. The brilliant part. Is that there's no reversal. He gets away with it.
And
friend has a shit life. His wife dies. His son. Oh, it's so black.
One of his daughters gets some horrible disease.
Yeah, yeah. And her teeth all fall out. And her hair falls out.
Yeah.
And her child dies of stillbirth.
Yeah. It's just like, it's like everything. And
he's cheering it all. I thought at some point he'd go, this has gone too far. But he's going, yes.
Yeah, I was expecting that too. He is the most irredeemably evil character in the most petty. I mean, talk about the banality of evil. He is so banal, and he's so petty, and he never gets
a comeuppance.
Absolutely awful. And sort of like at the end of the story is, and his friend has died, and he's
street.
Before his friend died, he lost his business, he lost his family. It's like a Job story, right? I'll take everything away from you, everything away, except, you know, it's our protagonist who really should be repenting and going, oh, actually, sorry. And the end of the story is the guy is out there on his deck or something with his wife.
They drive past where the devil had been, where he...
Oh, that's right, yeah. And they're kind of looking at the stars, and he's still there going, I want more.
Yeah, he wants more.
It's not enough. He's just awful.
More carnage, I know.
And that's something Stephen King has always done really well, is to just keep pushing and not relent from whatever point he's trying to make, whatever, you know, message he's getting across or the story. And you just kept waiting for this character to go, I've gone too far, what can I do? And he never does. It's a really awesome story. But it doesn't quite tonally belong with the other three.
You're right. I mean, we haven't spoken about 1922, which is the first story and the longest in the collection.
That's a really complicated story, because that's a guy who has who's basically plotted to kill his wife over a property issue. It's a rural story. She has some land. He has some land. She wants to sell it, move to the city, and he wants to keep the farm. And if she sells the land to this horrible big corporation who's going to buy it, they will sort of pollute the river, and so he'll lose his farm anyway. So he convinces his teenage son to help him kill his wife, his son's mother, and throw her down a well in the...
And I don't know, Kat, if you know this, but it doesn't go well from
there.
It doesn't go well.
he's actually awful. He's a awful, misogynistic, small-minded, nasty man.
Racist man.
But somehow Stephen King manages to write him so that every now and then you forget about all that and you kind of like him, because it's a first-person narrative, so you're in this guy's head, and you kind of just start to coming around every now and then he'll just say something awful, and it's like, oh, no, that's right, you're an asshole. I hope you get eaten by the rats.
Yeah, that's he gets a whole rat fixation.
Yeah.
He thinks his dead wife's become the ruler of all the rats, and so it gets a bit Edgar Allan Poe.
But it's not
fantastical specific. Well, it might be supernatural.
I think it either has to be supernatural, or he's really botched the ending.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's a real skill that King has to make you feel empathy for really horrible characters. Not necessarily all the way, but with these little like waves of empathy of like, because bad things happen to this guy too, and every now and then it's like, oh, it's really, oh, And then he says something, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'm glad that bad thing happened to you.
It's all racist.
He's racist. He's just, he's awful. And yet King manages to write him as a person, not just as, yes, that racist, misogynist asshole.
So you would recommend this?
I'd recommend it if it's sort of...
I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read it.
Dark.
That's all right. You're busy.
You know, if this kind of really dark, nasty, quite pessimistic, really... Although the last story is not. So if he hadn't ended the collection with a good marriage and the way that ended, I think you might have been needing some razor blades. Yeah,
warn people that it's king at his dark.
Yeah, and there's not many men in that story who are... There's one guy in the last story, the detective who comes in at the end. He's almost not a character.
Well, he's 95 years old.
Yeah, and he's not really a character. He's just like a denouement for the story. But yeah, it's good. It's Stephen King being Stephen King, straight down the line.
So let's move on. This is the book that I recommended was, among others, by Joe Walton. And it's basically a book about a girl who has just survived a terrible situation. Basically, her mum's a witch, and her mum has and Maury, is it Maury?
She alternates between Maury and Maury.
Okay, so Maury and her twin sister, whose name is, I think, Maury.
It's Morgana and Maury. Her name is Morwenna. They're Welsh. And the protagonist's name is Morwenna. Her sister was Morgana. But they both called each other Mor when they were
Which isn't
young.
Confusing at all.
It's not, because her sister's hardly...
Well, she's dead. So, and that's not a spoiler, that she's dead from the fourth page. Basically, the twins have fought the mum in a climactic magical battle.
Something happened.
Yeah, we don't really know.
Involving a car.
And the twin sister gets run over by a car as part of the magical battle. And Moore, our protagonist, she basically puts up her hand and says,
She ends up with a bad leg and a,
yeah, but she ends up going to live with her father who had,
because she stayed with her grandfather for a while, but then her grandfather got sick, so the UK equivalent of community services sort of took her away, and she had a father who was estranged. But still her father, so they stuck her with him.
And then
they promptly sent her off to quite a high-class boarding school.
Now, the thing about this book is that it's part fantasy, so it's got fairies in it, weird fairies.
Good fairies.
Good fairies. But it's also a dialogue with 1970s science fiction fandom. So it's a bizarre book in that sense that it's... It moves weirdly between these. Oh, and it's also a coming-of-age... Well, it's not really a coming-of-age story because... Well, I don't know.
I would say it's a coming-of-age story, yeah.
Okay, so it's a coming-of-age story and, yeah, it's definitely a dialogue with 1970s fandom and the books that were published at that point, and basically sitting in an SF group and speaking about these books. In amongst all this, the mother, who's still alive, is sending more taunting letters with her face burnt out... photos, and so we know there's going to be some sort of climactic thing with the mother again towards the end of the novel. But again, that all seems on the side of everything. So,
and it's quite an anticlimax too when it.
Well, actually,
it does happen.
I thought the ending was shithouse, but anyway.
Oh no!
But anyway, not that I'm holding back my words.
So I'm not sure I've ever had a reading experience like this where. I mean, it's beautifully written. It moves very quickly. I couldn't really put it down to read it in about 2 days. It's very affecting on one level, but on another level, it made no emotional sense to me whatsoever. Because half the book is about fandom and this sort of evangelical come-to-Jesus book about how science fiction saves you, which, I am part of that church. And the other half is about fairies and real magic. And Joe Walton has made it very clear that she does not approve of any interpretation of this book that does not take the magic as real.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't understand, if you know magic is real and are capable of practicing it and have factual evidence that fairies are real, why you would give a crap about Worldcon. That is the social climax of this book. She goes to Worldcon or makes plans to go to Worldcon. And I don't get that. I don't get that at all. Why she would never – she keeps talking about her carass. It's this word from Vonnegut, which is never explained in the book. I had to look it up. Even though I love Vonnegut, I don't particularly care for Slaughterhouse-Five, which I think
is the book that comes from.
But
you get the context.
I got it from the context, but I mean it's – I think that word was she never reads Vonnegut and goes, oh, I love this word. It's just used, which says a lot to me about what an insider book this truly is. I felt very excluded from it because those are not the science fiction books that I grew up with. I am of a totally different generation. And I forgot what I was saying before about Worldcon.
If you know magic is real, why would you worry?
Why would the Karas thing? So she wants a Karas. She wants this group of people who will know her soul. And she feels like she's found it, and she never tells them that magic is real. If any of you jerks know that magic is real, you have to tell us. Like, you have to tell me.
But she tells Wim.
Yeah, but, I mean, she does... The magic never seems real to me because she does not behave as a science fiction fan who knew magic was real would behave, I think. And... I don't know. It just didn't... Those two things did not sit particularly... easily with me throughout the book. The fandom seemed to be all out of proportion in importance given the cosmic life and death battle that she's having. It would be as though Frodo was like, well, that was all good. I really can't wait for a World Fantasy Convention. But, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. And so on the one hand, I was really enjoying this book, and it's very affecting, clearly very personal and autobiographical. And on the other hand, it just broke my brain in that I never believed any of the reactions. And this book is beloved. I mean, our geek crowd, we love this book. Again, with the come to Jesus story, like it appeals to us. It tells us how special we are in so many ways. That I mean, I'm not sure I have read a negative review of this book online. And
no,
there are a couple.
I have not come across them. but I feel like it's a schizophrenic book. And it wants to be two things at once, and I'm not sure. I think it succeeds at both of those things separately, but it. Not at the same time.
I think the fanish side of it comes out a little bit when she's questioning the Karas, and then she goes into this whole thinking process of have I manipulated reality itself? Because basically she's got no friends, so she does a magic thing to get friends to come to her. So she's thinking, well, have I manipulated these people's lives to the point where they're now my friends? And in fact, the reading group, which she didn't notice before until she did the magic, she's saying, well, did that not even exist? Have I actually created manipulated reality to the point where this reading group has now popped up? So that's a very... There's a lot of fanish thinking there.
It is.
Or at least SF thinking.
Yeah.
I really like the way that the magic worked in the book.
Did they give you the shits though?
No, I really like the because
it's magic that's based around reality.
It's like a reverse engineering kind of magic because you want if you work the magic to make something like to wish for something, the magic doesn't just go oh pop there it is. The magic probably changes what's happened retrospectively to make this come about, and it's never a magic you could point to and say, see, look there, I made that chair appear, because the way you would have made that chair appear is the magic would have made someone out of that room go, I might just take this chair over here now, and so you could never say
you can't prove it. Except
that's what the magic is.
She stuffs that up at the end when her mum and her have their climactic battle. I suppose that's a spoiler. And it's all magic and stuff and trees doing things and it's she's actually
She kind of goes back on the
She shits on the rules.
Yeah,
you can't do that. Not when I'm reading the book. And that annoyed me. But on
so why did you recommend this book?
I didn't. Oh, did I?
Yes.
Oh, because I hadn't read it. and I heard it was. And as Kat said, I heard it was beloved of many of the geek. And to be frank, I didn't hate it. I enjoyed actually the reading experience. And also, Joe Walton writes some really good articles on Tor.com.
Oh, and I love many of her other books. I adore Tooth and Claw.
Which I haven't read. This is the first Joe Walton
I've read. I love Tooth and Claw. And I was I got an arc of this, and I was excited to read it. And I'm not sorry that I read it, but I mean, the other thing is that a lot of the geeky reviews of it, rather than, you know, professional reviewers and stuff, you know, live journal reviews, talk about how well it reflected their experience of discovering fandom. And it reflected mine not at all. In fact, it seemed almost like a fairy tale of a world I can't even imagine having come across as a child. I never was part of a science fiction reading group. I lived on the West Coast, where there are far fewer conventions than on the East Coast of America. I never found fandom as a child. So it was like looking at this sort of, to me, impossibly idealized life where, yes, your mother abuses you, but she does it with magic, and then you get to go to Worldcon. And that was not my abusive childhood, and I didn't find fandom that way. And so that it has become this sort of universal clarion call to our collective experience kind of leaves me in the cold, because these are not books, as I said, you know, these are 1970s science fiction. It's not what I read growing up. And it really excludes a lot of fantasy, oddly enough, for the books that she reads and that she lauds. And I mean, honestly, at least 20% of this book is book reviews. You know, she reviews the books that she reads, and it's a little weird and disconcerting. But most of them are science fiction. For all that she lives in, her world is fantasy oriented. And so it seems a closed world to
me. Well, maybe she needed a break from all the magic. That's why she's reading so much Delaney and Voldemort and Heinlein. She loves Heinlein.
Because the magic that's happening is kind of understated, and it's not a magic that you get to control in any great way, at least possibly when you're young. I mean, maybe her mother was a lot better at controlling the magic. I sort of read that as it's just kind of part of her world, and it's something that's there and that kind of happens, but you don't really get to do much with it. And so she has this other life, and it's probably no different to, you know, if you're a child in a circus,
But I think if you're a child in a circus, you wouldn't be getting all sexy about the Worldcon.
No, but would you be so keen about circuses? I mean, you'd probably have something else that you're going on to.
Maybe I was a more practical, but Moore is a pretty practical child.
She's
I would be reading fantasy books in order to figure out how magic worked. Like, I mean, like what?
She seems to know how it works.
Yeah,
she's just saying. She says a few times. She goes, "It's not like in the books. Like I've read the books. It's not like that." And maybe that's why she doesn't read a lot of magical fantasy books, because they're not reflecting her experience.
I mean, I just didn't feel like the fantasy part actually intersected. I felt like that was the Joe Walton part.
It was a strange...
And so it's the books that she loved as a young girl, and I didn't actually feel that they emotionally or thematically intersected with the rest of the book at all.
Yeah.
And so I didn't feel like it was a commentary on anything. I didn't feel like there was a reason for it. It was just the two narratives running parallel rather than intersecting.
What about the issue that it is semi-autobiographical? Because that's not on any of the cover flaps or anything. It doesn't say.
No.
Joe Walton's sort of quasi-memoir here. So if someone does review it, and like our podcast mate Macca, Jonathan McElmont, who said some very nice things about the podcast on Strange Horizons, thank you very
Moving
much,
Jonathan.
I'm just mentioning it as a tangent, who calls Walton potentially psychopathic. Well, calls the character more potentially psychotic, but actually psychopathic. Now, that's the character he's referring to. He's not actually referring to Joe Walton as being a psychopath. And maybe she is. In fact, her response on LiveJournal was to go, "Wah, ha, 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 ha," which is, you know, what psychopaths do.
That was the joke.
The appropriate reaction to being called a psychopath is maniacal laughter. So she's taking as meaning her.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So she gets... So this is a book about her just with a bit of magic thrown in. Yeah. So, but the reader won't necessarily know. Unless you're part of the geek world,
what does it matter? But what does it matter?
Well, if you write a review, I'll tell you why.
I mean, to be fair, the reason I knew that is because she told me that. I mean, I had talked to her about the book at a convention.
If you write a review, about it and say, well, I think Moore is deranged or weird. And I actually think Moore is a bit strange because she gets sort of half abused by her father.
That's a really weird scene in the book.
She's staying with Dad and the three aunts, her father's sisters. She's in bed on the second night that she's there.
No, it's a hotel.
Oh, is it the hotel?
It's when they go and visit his father.
Oh, that's right, yeah. And the father wants to sleep. Get in bed with her.
It's this one because the book is written as in the form of a diary that Moore keeps, and there's just this one entry which is kind of
Dad wanted to shag me tonight. So it doesn't say it that way.
No,
it's in a more subtle tone.
But it's a very matter of fact, and then it's never ever mentioned again. And it's just, it's a weird
though her relationship with her father is kind of
boyfriend-y. It is kind of weird, but it's just a weird little.
Well, that's my point. Tick. Moore is weird. Now, that could have had, for all I know, Joe Walton had that experience. I don't know. It's semi-autobiographical.
But it shouldn't matter. I mean...
But if I then go and review it and I say, that's fucked, what happened there. That's the worst bit of writing ever. Why would you even refer to it? That's just fucked. And then Joe Walton gets on and goes, wah-ha-ha-ha, on a live journal. And all her fans get on and comment and say that I'm a fucking penis for saying that Joe Walton's fucked, even though I'm referring to the penis of the character,
I think that's...
Do you see where it gets muddled?
That's the risk a writer accepts when you use memoir and autobiography in a story. And it is a story. It's not a memoir. This is not, among others, a memoir by Joe Walton. And that's the risk you run. That's the risk any writer runs when you use autobiography. And it's not the responsibility necessarily of the reviewer or the critic to try and unravel which parts of the book might actually be the writer. So should you mention them or which parts? No, that's if you are using your own life as material for your writing, that becomes your writing and your fiction, and you don't get to come back to that.
But
and say,
Jonathan, 80 comments on a live journal where he gets slapped around for being, and he's actually as the reviewer, he's the one who's called cold and detached because he didn't get hurt. And a fucking arsehole.
I know.
And he is a bit of an arsehole, but I mean,
I don't think the comment. I'm not sure it was. The comment that Joe Walton put on her live journal I don't think was particularly bad. It was like tongue-in-cheek and funny. What she should have done as soon as those comments started was close down the comments say, guys, it's... if it wasn't tongue-in-cheek, then...
But no, I'm sure it was tongue-in-cheek. But the thing is that if you keep a live journal, if you keep a blog, you know what's going to happen if you link to a review that.
But she should have linked to it and
said nothing, and those comments would still be there. Because everyone wants to rally on your own journal to make you feel good because we're all friends on live journal.
And what she should have shut down.
She had to know that there was going to be a dog pile on that reviewer and clearly was okay with that happening.
Yeah, because she doesn't... Mm-hmm. I mean, the lynch mob comes out, burn effigies of Jonathan, and she doesn't come and say, look, people...
And she should have... Because she did come back and re-comment a few times to people.
Yeah, she came back and said... Not necessarily against Jonathan, but just on points.
Like, she was interacting.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of not on. And that's... Like I said, that's... If you use memoir in your books, and whether or not you come clear about that, whether or not you actually, in interviews and whatever, you say, oh, well, this is largely autobiographical. The thing is, you've written a novel, you've written fiction, and it's completely different to someone writing a memoir or an autobiography where there could perhaps be more sensitivity taken by reviewers knowing they're talking about someone's actual life. If you're writing fiction, I don't care where you get your material. You don't have a comeback to feel personally insulted. You don't even have a comeback for... If you write a fiction and a reviewer reviews it and said, this doesn't make sense, this wouldn't happen, it's ludicrous, you can't even come back to that and say, well, actually, it did happen, it's my life. Because if you've not written it well enough to convince the reader that your story is something they feel is real... then you've just not written it well enough. And so the comeback of saying that it is real, it happened.
So we all agree on this.
Yeah. In terms of the complaining about the review of
no,
conflating the character with the author.
Yeah, the idea that that she thinks it's a memoir or a memoir. I don't think she believes in fairies. Don't know. Does she believe in fairies, Kat?
I don't know.
No, she said
I don't
no.
think she thinks it's fully memoir, but, I mean, obviously this is using memoir in conjunction yeah. with fantasy.
Actually,
and that's part of what's interesting about it. That's part of why it is an arresting book, because it's a technique we don't see very often. And I absolutely do think this is part of something I'm interested in science fiction and fantasy, in the intersection of personal experience mm-hmm. and genre tropes, that I did not I keep using the word intersect, but I bounced off of it in certain ways does not mean it's not an interesting experiment, and does not mean that other people clearly attach to it hugely.
Yeah, the investment in this book actually scares me just a little.
It's evangelical. It really is. It's because we are part of this small cult. I know that's a scary word, but we are. Joe Walton is famous for her Protocols of Science Fiction essays. You know, we have these protocols. We have these words that we all understand. We have, you know, our little handshakes and symbols and all of that kind of stuff. We are part of this world. And what this book says is that that world is actually magic. Is as good as real magic, and this book is all about how awesome we are as fans, and so it is like someone getting up at a church on a Wednesday night and testifying as to how Christ saved them. I was raised Christian Scientist, and I say Wednesday night because that's testify night in a Christian Science church. No, Sunday is when you go to church, but Wednesday night is when you go and you have cookies and you talk about how Christian Science healed you. And the energy in the room just ramps up and up and up as the stories get wilder and wilder. And you get this weird sort of climax and denouement and the whole thing. And that is part of evangelical Christianity. I'm not saying that fandom is evangelical Christianity, but this is an evangelical text. It is meant to communicate how good our world is to the people inside that world, not the people outside it.
So this isn't a breakout novel, a mainstream breakout novel for the...
I don't see how it could possibly be. And no. I know it says that on the cover, that it's a possible breakout novel.
I can't imagine how
it could be a breakout novel. This is incomprehensible to people who are not already part of fandom. I can't imagine giving it to, like, my father or... My family is not geeky or fanish at all. I think my mother would be totally put off by this book because there's no entry point for her. You know, she's not part of this culture. She hasn't read those books. It's just like it came from, you know, ancient India or something.
And the story itself is in sort of interrogating the fantasy genre anyway, because this is an after story, because we've had the huge big magic battle between the mother and her daughters, and one daughter has died and the other one has been left crippled, but sacrifices have been made and the world has been saved, and this is where the curtain closes on a traditional fantasy story. And now this is a story that comes after, when that daughter who's left has to just go to boarding school and do homework and sit exams.
That was the nice thing, that no one gives a shit. You've saved the world.
Yeah, and
it's not like Doctor Who where no one...
But that's an interrogation of genre. Yeah, and if you're not versed in genre to some extent... Yeah, it's quite a flat story. I found it a really interesting story. This is what happens when Frodo gets back. And he doesn't go off with the elves. He's actually got to just build a house and garden and go to the shops and squabble with his hobbit neighbours. And it doesn't really matter that he dropped the ring into Mordor, because life goes on.
Before we move on, just for the sake of Jonathan, can I ask both of you, her examination of how to use sticky hot buns to get friends... Is that psychotic?
No, that's teenage girl.
Yeah, and did you...
No, I agree.
Is
it psychotic in that it's a mercenary outsider's approach to social interaction? I don't think that's the definition of
psychopathy. Because she uses the buns to get friends.
But that's what you do. I brought gum to get friends. I was an unpopular
She doesn't use the buns to get friends. The buns are emblematic of the system of trade in the school and popularity... And you get buns back, and it's perfect teenage girl politics.
She didn't create that system.
It's perfect.
No, I don't think that's psychopathic. I think that is very symptomatic of a child who does not instinctively get social norms taking on an understandable system in order to access them, yeah. Which is pretty much most geeks, and, yeah. and me included.
So, Jonathan, you quote, fucking arsehole, end quote, you were wrong. Okay, moving right along.
I can edit
so,
that
no,
out.
I don't edit that. He's from Scotland. He wouldn't know anyway. This goes on the internet, doesn't it?
It goes on the internet.
Yeah, it's all right. He said nice things about the podcast on Strange Horizons. Did I mention that already?
I actually think I will link to the review in the show notes, but I think a lot of what Jonathan said in his review was fairly spot on. I didn't agree with his characterization of Moore, but a lot like he was talking about how I guess the celebration of this book as a celebration of socially dysfunctional geeky fandom was possibly a bit off base.
Can we also? Well, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, can we also link to the review that Jo Walton likes the most, because she linked to it herself, by Russ Albury, which interestingly enough, which is this one here. Now you've seen. Now that you've seen the web address,
you can give me those notes later. I'll put them in the website.
Who actually never mentions that this is a memoirish autobiographical, but he absolutely adores the character of Moore because he identifies.
I liked Moore a lot.
I mean, honestly, no matter what Joe says, I think the book works a lot better if we understand the magic as Moore is a very damaged person about childhood abuse, and that it isn't actually real. I think that, and I almost never take that position. I will always fall on the side of magic is real. I have retconned the end of Pan's Labyrinth in my head so that there's no question. but I think that the work works better if the magic isn't real. And I don't agree with her insistence on the book's reading either. I think that once a book is published and in the world, people can read it however they want.
Did she say that publicly? That it's
it was,
that the magic
she's actually said she said she said yeah, what I wrote was unquestionably fiction and fantasy. It has magic and fairies. She's absolutely saying it is. But I think what I really liked about it was you're just never sure. And I like that the book ends for me on an ambiguity of it might be magic and that would be okay.
No, sorry.
And it might not be magic and that would be okay.
She has a climactic battle with her mother, which has magical stuff going on.
But the whole book is Moore's diary. It's what she is writing down.
Okay.
This is not a narrative around Moore. Only narrator.
It is Moore's fiction about
it's
herself.
It's her fiction. Okay. So what is she...
Yeah. I really do feel that it works better if I just make it in my head that the magic isn't real. Because otherwise, the emotional truth of the novel falls apart for me.
Mm.
Okay, so, well, cool. I still think it's a great read.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot.
You found it readable too,
so
we all think you should read it. Now we've spoiled it, you probably don't need to, but...
No, there's lots in there we haven't talked about.
Yeah, true. Okay, so, book number three.
Book number three, which Kat recommended.
Which I had not read. I was under the impression it had to be a recent book, and I was getting ready to go on tour, and so I thought, I really want to read this one. So, two birds with one stone.
So that's China Mayville's Embassy Town, which is his is it his first SF pure SF novel?
I would say so. Yes,
audience, are we all getting?
Unless it depends. It depends how you treat City in the City.
Let's not go back there, Kirsten. Let's not speak of that book again. So, do you want to describe it, Kat, or can you not be bothered? I'm not prejudicing your remarks.
No, you know what? You're much better. Why don't you do the summary? You're much better with the
summary. I'll just read the back cover blurb because it's a reasonably complicated story, and the back cover blurb actually spoils most of the novel anyway.
Really?
It does, yeah.
Okay.
Brief. Embassy Town, a city of contradictions on the outskirts of the universe. Avis is an immerser, a traveller on the Immer, the sea of space and time below the everyday, now returned to her birth planet. Here on Arieka. I love how you know the words. If I ever get them wrong, you know them.
And it's a vis.
You're the. Why is it a vis and not avis?
Because China says so.
Okay. You really are the wind beneath my wings. You really are. Especially when it comes to weird words in books. Humans are not the only intelligent life, and a vis has a rare bond with the natives, the enigmatic hosts who cannot lie. I threw the American voice again. Only a teeny cadre of unique human ambassadors can speak language. with a big L language, and connect the two communities. But an unimaginable new arrival has come to Embassy Town, and when this ambassador speaks, everything changes. Catastrophe looms. Avis knows the only hope is for her to speak directly to the alien hosts, and that is impossible. That actually
that doesn't really give away. No, that's good.
Oh, we'll give it away
then. That's a good blurb.
Basically, they're on a planet at the edge of the universe, and there's all these weird aliens, and there's a little embassy town in the middle of all the weird aliens, and the weird aliens speak in language, capital L language, which means that...
The language doesn't signify.
Yeah, the language doesn't... Thank you very much. The language doesn't signify. So they need ambassadors who can... basically, if you speak their language back to them, just as we're doing now... In one voice, they don't understand what you're saying. You've got to speak it through the turn and the cup, through two voices.
The aliens have a dual voice, so they have two mouths that speak together.
It. You say this better than me.
And their language has no signifiers. It's a purely referential language, so which is it's really... complicated and interesting, actually, the way
you
describe it.
Well, just means
there's
no signifiers, though.
Yeah. Well, there's no conceptual element to the language.
But there must be some kind of preconception for them to actually conceive of the idea of needing signifiers. It's very complicated.
It sounds like
but,
it. Yeah.
But
actually, I didn't think of that.
Preconception of it, but just because they can have a preconception doesn't mean they can articulate... that in words without having the object they're referring
it's like
to
the,
when
the
they
Star Trek episode.
I read the book.
The Darmok and Tanab.
Yeah.
There's a Star Trek Next Generation episode where these aliens speak only in references to things that have happened in their culture.
Yeah.
Like Shaka when the walls fell.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
So it's similar. So basically, it's a copy of a Next Gen episode.
It is slightly better than the Next Gen episode.
That was a great Next Gen episode.
It was a great Next Gen episode.
I got all weepy watching that one. But that's right.
And the way the ambassadors work is the only way they've been able to, and they kind of stumbled across the reason why. But the only way they've been able to communicate with the Arikai is to breed humans. Human twins, genetic twins, who are then raised identically as one person, essentially. They are treated as one person. So they all have two-syllable names, and that is the name of them as a
like
unit.
Magda.
And Ezra. And Calvin.
Dun.
Yeah. And they think practically in unison, and they can talk in unison, and therefore they can... communicate with... They can speak language, capital L language.
It's to the point that every single morning when they get up, if one of them has a wrinkle that the other one doesn't, either they get rid of the wrinkle or they add the wrinkle to the other one. That's how careful it has to be done.
Yeah.
And only doing that can they communicate with these weird insectoid... What are you know what? I never pictured
they're,
the aliens in my
they're
head.
They're sort of insectoid.
It's not a strongly visual novel to me, anyway.
No.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they have instars, I-N-S-T-A-R, which are transitional periods for insects. I checked that up on Google.
Because
I didn't fucking know what the word meant. And
there's mention, I think, at one point of carapaces and things. I think they're sort of insectoid.
Can you tell me where the wings were? There were fan wings and gift wings.
I think the fan wing was at
the back of the head.
Because they communicate through, they hear through the one of the wings.
Yeah.
And that's what...
We're doing a real good job.
Something nasty happens at the end. So basically you have, and the reason humans are on this planet is because it's they trade with the Arikai for bioorganisms and biotechnology, and so they're there to trade, and the embassy is set up to communicate with the Arikai, and Avis is a traveller who's...
She's been out in the Imma, which is basically another word for hyperspace.
Hyperspace, yeah. And
why could it just used hyperspace?
Because
you want things to be a little more interesting.
For goodness
come on.
Sake.
No, but
I mean,
no,
it's much
I
like
the
Dune.
Imma.
It's very much like the pilots in Dune.
Yeah, it is. Mm. But I'm not saying that for the laugh. Didn't get much of one. but I'm asking more there's a perfectly good SF term to use, and
It's different. It's not hyperspace anyway. It is quite different. The properties of the Immer are quite different, and it's more like ocean.
I'm sorry, China.
I've been schooled. If you actually used hyperspace, you would get lots of images of faster than light travel and zoom and
well, and this is an entire book about linguistics. Words matter. Like
I'm sorry.
But yeah, so and the new ambassador who comes, whose name is Ezra, is different because Ezra is not twins. Ezra is two separate people who grew up together, look nothing like each other, unrelated, and are able to speak language through a quirk of Ez.
Yes.
Yes.
And when they do, though, it has horrible repercussions.
Yeah,
Basically, the aliens get hooked on Ezra's form of language, which is slightly different to the ambassador's form of language, and it becomes a drug. And so the Arakai are mostly peace-loving and mum beans and all that.
Arakai.
But when they hear the language spoken by Ezra, they go fucking nutsoid. And if they don't get their fill... No, they do, because if they don't get their fill, they want to rip people to...
In the
nicest way possible way.
Why?
Disagree with me.
Let me show you. They don't. A group of... the ones who are... I mean, they get quite demanding. Like, they want to hear language. They want another fix and, you know... and for some of them, it's they need new words too. They can't just hear old words. They need new words. The old words don't work anymore. But it's a group of them who decide that because their culture is basically just dying. Their technology is bio as well, so it can get infected and become addicted.
Their houses become addicted.
And so a group of them have decided that the only way to get around this problem is to mutilate themselves and then forcibly mutilate others so that they can't hear language anymore, which then actually robs them of language because there's no intermediary between what they're thinking and saying... there isn't. So if you they can't, they just can't speak it, and it's a really horrible, it's a really horrible thing that they to desperately try and escape.
Yeah. But we missed the point that a vis is a simile.
Oh, vis is a simile because what in their interactions with the humans, and this is what I meant by there must be some pre-conceptualization of new concepts because. They one of the things they do is interact with the humans by making them into similes because their language is still just referential. So
they have to make
they have to make
Shaka when the walls fell happen before they can use that term.
So Avis is a simile. She's the girl who ate what was given her. So they actually had Avis when she was a girl and they took her somewhere and they we don't exactly know what happened, but it wasn't nice. And therefore she is a real girl who ate what was given her and therefore they can then use that simile because it's not a figure of speech.
As long as she's there, the moment she leaves, when she went to the Immer, they couldn't use that simile anymore because she wasn't there.
No, because she was always... There's another guy who... He's the guy who swims with fishes every day. He actually has to swim with fishes every day.
Otherwise the simile
or he doesn't work as a referent.
And in amongst all this, this is early on, the some of these hosts, as I'm going to call them because I can't pronounce their real name, also try to lie. This is their big thing, that they've got language. Language requires, it doesn't have that conceptual element. So to get it, so one of their big things is if they're able to lie, that shows that they've, well, it's like a game to
them. It's like a game. It's like an extreme sport. They have the Festival of Lies, and they try to lie, and most of them can't.
This doesn't. You know, the way we've described it sounds really dull.
Yeah.
No,
which
I mean,
is interesting because I think it is dull. But
I think it's really good. I liked Embassy Town a lot.
I was so terribly strongly reminded of Babel 17, the Delaney novel, and at the same time of Ian Banks' novels. I want my husband to read this because he loves Ian Banks and he loves Delaney. I think he would probably really like this. But it didn't read like a Mieville novel to me at all.
But his novels are also different.
Well, they are, but there was just no emotional connection to me. I didn't find any emotional content in this book at all. I didn't find the strong visuals that he usually has. I didn't find the language to be the level that he usually engages language on, which is weird for a book that's completely about language.
Yeah.
But because it's about language, the style is ramped back.
It's a very transparent style.
And so it felt very strange to me. I really felt like I was reading an Ian Banks book. Even down to the hosts, which are could be transplanted into any Ian Banks novel. Unfortunately, I am not a big fan of Ian Banks. I do think there are people for whom this is a great book. I am not one of them. Mm-hmm. I am not the target audience for this book, as we say.
Which is fair enough.
But at the same time, it slid so completely off my brain. I found even concentrating on page by page to be extremely difficult, which is interesting given that the difficulty of communication is a big theme in the book. I found it strange that the cover flap of my edition talks about the trend-setting nature of this book, because I think it's very old. It's a very new way of science fiction. It's very old school science fiction, and borrows a lot from. I don't feel that of all of his books, I feel this is the least trend setting. I think this sits very firmly in a tradition of science fiction.
Oh, I think so.
And is not any kind of envelope pusher.
I love the idea of the language and the host, but I agree with you. I couldn't get into Avice. Am I saying it right now?
She's
very detached.
Yeah, I couldn't connect with her as a character.
She gets more emotional towards the last third, but for a good two thirds of the book, she's so detached and so. I mean, she's a floker, which is meant to be, I don't know, sort of a bit of driftwood that floats between. Sort of a. Apathetic isn't the right word, but
no, it's not apathetic. She just kind of drifts around, and I liked her. I didn't.
But explain something. Tell me what she is. Apart from that, she's been in the IMA.
She's been
a pilot in the IMA. What can you tell me about her?
Well, she's travelled a lot. She's seen a lot.
Yeah, you just repeated what we
grown
just said.
Up on. Okay. Well, she's grown up in Embassy Town. She's come back to Embassy Town, which is not common. Usually, if you leave, you leave.
But do you know what her better desires?
None of that is not on the back cover.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the reason she's come back is because she came back because her husband wanted to come to Embassy Town, and it's nearly impossible to get to Embassy Town.
But even that relationship between her and her husband. I'm sorry, I'm cutting you off. I know it's very rude.
It's very
but crazy. Very rude. But, that's not a pointy stick.
No,
that's a bit of shit you threw at me. Not actual feces.
Paperclip.
I should tell people who can't. So she can actually throw shit at me. The thing is, she comes back with her husband, Sile, Silly.
Skeel.
Oh, fuck, I hate these names. And Skeel. S-C-I-A-S-C-I-L-E.
I thought the names are very Banksian, too, actually.
Skeel. But only because he wants to.
Yes.
That's a relationship that has no emotion to it.
The novel opens at the end. Because it's told in two parts. There's like a before and an after sort of thing. But it opens at a point where Avice is kind of in limbo because her marriage is all but broken down.
Yeah.
She can't leave yet because there's nothing.
Because the ships that come to pick people up only come.
They take a while.
Forever. It takes a while.
So she's kind of in limbo, and the detached quality of her narrative, and she's actually telling, this is a book, she's telling a story. Consciously telling you the history of what's happened and the way she's been able to try and piece it together. And I think her detachment partially comes from the fact that she is consciously telling the history of Embassy Town.
Yeah.
And I think it also, because she's compared with, is it Ursel? I can't remember the Autumn's name, her friend.
Ursel, yeah.
I love the twinning of these, because the novel is full of twins, and I love the twinning of her with the Autumn and the who's more human and who's less human. And I thought it was a really nice. There's that beautiful scene where she's really upset, and Ursel downloads into a body with like a fairly clunky autumn body, but it has arms so she can hug her. And I thought that was really...
Yeah, that's a nice moment.
Nicely
But she's the least interesting character in the whole novel. Her husband, who goes mad, is so much more interesting than her.
I don't think he's...
He is, because he's the one who comes up with all the bizarre theories about the hosts and gets all militant about it and then drifts...
I see her as a...
She does nothing until the last third. And when she does in the last third, it's so conveniently plotted. In the sense that she's able to figure something out. Basically, again, spoilers. Basically, the Ezra, who is the ambassador who is the drug, dies. Gets killed. So now they don't have the second part, which means their drug supply has disappeared. They figure a short-term way around that, but really they need a long-term answer, because what's happening is that the guys who have ripped their ears off, that's the aliens who have ripped their ears off, have now amassed an army so large, it's huge. They can't stop it. It's coming to Embassy Town and it's going to kill them all, because what the huge army wants is to get rid of the drug so that its young, who will be born with the ears, will be born free. They'll be born where there won't be any drug addiction anymore. So they want to get rid of the pests. Humans are the pests. Avis. She comes up with a daring plan to fix it all. But at no point before that had I seen her as someone like MacGyver or... Mm-hmm. No, not MacGyver, but someone who could actually come up with anything. MacGyver. Yeah, linguistics MacGyver. There was no feeling that she could actually come up with anything, and then suddenly she's, bang, I've got an idea. Like a light bulb just appears on top of her head.
But it's the idea that's been with her all along. She's been surrounded by the similes and her husband, who's the linguist. No, it's there, and I think it's a really good ending to the book. Actually, I was wondering how he was going to be able to end it.
And then with 2 weeks to go, because these things are 2 weeks to get there, or they speak in kilo hours, and that got annoying. Rather than years and weeks and days, they speak in hours. And as they're getting closer. What she decides on, it's like, really, get out of here if you don't want to hear. She basically decides that the whole thing about the Festival of Lies and the crowding similes and all that stuff, as you've just said, was actually a hint that language is potentially maybe one step of the process, and that really, ultimately, some of the Arakai want to communicate like we communicate.
She doesn't decide that. Because there's a movement within. There's even an assassination by the guy who's wanting to learn how to lie.
All right, so the hosts.
It's not. You know, Avis comes and saves the day. It's like she's there with a Spanish dancer and the other.
But fundamentally, she teaches them how to lie. I mean, basically to communicate.
They were almost there. They were learning themselves, and she kind of goes to boot camp.
It's so quick and...
It's not it's quick. Not all of them...
It's 2 weeks. Because there's a plot reason that it has to be quick.
Yeah,
it's a major change to their society.
But they've been... And she doesn't teach them all.
I'm not emotional
all,
about this at all.
But she doesn't teach them all. She has a group of the Ariekai who have been part of the movement to change language and to move on. And who have been teaching themselves to lie.
Yeah, I found it interesting what you were saying the other night when we were talking about the colonial theme of that ending.
Well, yeah, just that they're born. When they go through four phases, these aliens, and their third phase is when they get consciousness, and they're immediately, language is what they're born with in that third phase. So it's natural to them. Now, as a result of all this, they're taught to speak like us from that third phase. They're taught to take language away. And to become more like us in communication, so to language with a little L rather than the big L.
They teach themselves.
It doesn't matter.
No, it does matter because
it's a natural part of them.
Okay, but hang on.
It's so terrible, this idea that they're sort of forcing their children, who are this new generation, to be born. Because remember, the ones who tore their ears out were doing it specifically so their children could be born with pure language. You wouldn't have to worry about all this shit. There's one little subgroup that, as you say, wants to move forward. But now everyone is being forced to learn how to speak like us. And to me, that is so terrible.
It's not like us, because they don't... They still talk. Because the other side of the coin is if you're going to go all post-colonial on China's ass.
Yeah. You're right.
What do you mean? No. The other side of the coin is, okay, so you've come to this new exotic world and they're so beautiful and they're so natural. You should leave them as they are. Don't let them change. Don't let them get any ideas from us. Keep them in their reservations.
Have you not watched Star Trek? Have you not watched The Prime Directive? No, see, I mean, seriously. I mean, the thing is that they're obviously a culture. Look, they might have gone in that direction. They may have gone in that direction. And it might have been part of their revolutionary way, but it's forced upon them.
And in the order fact that, to save us.
Well, it's
yes,
come
in order to save our lives. Save because really what the humans should have done is gone hurry-curry on themselves, kill them all out, so that this society could have gone on.
Or leave.
They couldn't.
Well, they couldn't leave.
They couldn't leave. They were stuck there.
Mm.
You know,
yeah, but it's
obvious at this point. I was not actually able to finish the book.
But it's come. But the thing is, it has come from within the culture, and sure, it's come from an interaction with other cultures. But it's come from them, and the Ariekai who have been self-mutilating, and then you know, going around the place and forcibly mutilating. I mean, this is the thing. It's like when you're talking about. You know, they're doing it. It's not like they all band together and decide this is what we're going to do. No. You had a very small contingent of because they go insane.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there is. Right. I have to backtrack a little bit. I have to backtrack.
And they're forcing everyone else to lose.
But that's their. But that's them. They're doing it. We're not.
But the Ariekai who. Change that's come from them too. They're the ones who have been interacting with another culture and said, actually, there's something interesting here we might want from that culture. Let's make similes. Let's stretch our language. Let's try to make our language signifying. And they've done that themselves, and that's what they've done. So you have these two groups within a culture, and you've got one group saying we could develop. Because now we're interacting with other people, and you've got another group going, and you know, because it's been forced at because of a really horrible situation where it's quite desperate. But both solutions have come from within that group. Now, okay, sure, one group needs the help of a couple of humans to change that, but that's because we're really good at lying.
Yeah, no, I get that. And I know
so it's come from the group.
Avis gets the idea, actually, the final idea, from seeing the ones who have ripped their ears off
that's
communicate.
Right. Yeah.
Because they can't hear, but they still somehow are able to communicate. Yeah. So she figures out that they've got the potential to be able to communicate through things other than language, the capital L language. They can do it through, you know, symbols and shit like that. I get that. It just left a bad taste in my mouth. Because it felt like... Basically, the forced ruination of a culture as it was, and the fact that it's capital L language. So I'm about to get religious on everyone's ass here, but it felt to me like it was like the
No, but you can get religious because you've got Skeel and his cohorts who are running around
very
going
cultish, and that felt so.
And again, imposing the values of their own culture and saying again, it's this. It's the noble savage thing. It really is. It's like, no, they can't change. They're perfect the way they are.
No!
That's what you're saying.
But they're not... Oh, no, I'm not. No,
you're saying that language is theirs. It's their culture.
I'm saying that at the Instar 3, that is what they have. Let them develop naturally.
But they don't want that. There's a whole bunch... And when the Ariekai who've learnt to lie, when they come face-to-face with... the hordes who finally come in, the hordes don't just go, it doesn't matter, we don't want this, rip your ears off anyway. The hordes stop and go, well, so you guys aren't... Because getting the signifying language basically voids the addiction.
Okay. Thanks for recommending this one.
You know, if the hordes are...
Catch. now we're not friends anymore.
Yeah. So that's it. I mean, it is this... I mean...
Look. Okay, we could. We'll argue this another time. But actually, what would be nice is if anyone who hasn't been spoiled to death reads the book and gives us some feedback as to who's right, Kirsten and me. And if I'm the one who's right, that'll be great. So
when are you ever right?
I wasn't right about the last China book, but I think I'm right about this one. I have a hunch.
No, I don't, because if it was just the human beings imposing their culture and what they wanted to do. Then absolutely, but the thing is, it's come from within.
From some, yeah.
Themselves.
All right, fine. I get your point. You may be right. I'm not agreeing with you. So
I'm highly recommending Embassy Town.
We've got about 10 minutes. So okay. Do you want to kill it off? Unless you had any last thoughts.
No, Kat? I mean, I don't. It as I said, it bounced very hard off of my sensibilities, both aesthetically and narratively, and it's just not a book for me. But I mean, it is full of interesting ideas, and I think that there are a large number of people for whom this is a book for them, and I would not be surprised to see this on the big awards list.
Well, this
next year.
This will be NBC Town will get on a Hugo list, yeah. Definitely, because it's hard SF. Well, hardish SF, and among others, will probably get on World Fantasy and
probably the
Hugo's as well.
Too, yeah.
Yep.
I would think so.
Yeah, so I think you'll probably be seeing...
Probably, I would be shocked to see, among others, not on Hugo Nebula and World Fantasy. I think
So you'll be hearing these books again and again if you're in the geek world. If you're not, you won't ever hear of them. But, on an award list for next year. So, anyway...
You know, maybe not. Everyone thought Kraken was going to be on the list this year.
I think NBC Towns... Because it's SF.
It is.
And so it'll really push some people's
buttons. But there were tentacles in Kraken, I mean.
Yeah, but tentacles only really... go for some people. No, seriously, the Hugo voters are hullishing, are desperate for a really good science fiction novel. Whether this is it, I don't know, but this probably pushes enough buttons. And there's been some good, apart from my screaming and yelling 10 minutes ago, there's been some good discussion on it, good reviews of it. Anywho, let's finish, because we've got to wrap up, because we were given 2 hours by the lovely Julia, thank you very much, but we do have to stop, so that's it. Nah, okay, so feedback. Oh, we were going to do some feedback.
But we've run out of time.
So
we'll do that next time.
We apologise, Kat Sparks, not Kat Valenti. We were going to do some of your feedback, but we'll do it next week. Next month, not next week. Christ, doing this weekly would kill me. So please send feedback to Writer and the Critic, writerandcritic.posterous.com. That's posterous.com. The email is writerandcritic@gmail.com. We do respond. Please give us 5 stars on iTunes. And if you don't want to give us 5 stars, do it anyway. And 9th of July, we're going to have another special guest in 2 months. Who organised that?
That was you.
Ah, good. Again, I'm blamed. So we're going to have Cameron Rogers, who is the author of Music of Razors. And we'll be doing 3 books again, although we will be cutting down on the whole 3-book thing, except for November. Yeah. We've got another guest who's coming along. Christ, John Richards. But in between then, we should only be doing 2 books.
Definitely.
So Kirsten is recommending The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. Cameron Rogers is recommending World War Z by Max Brooks. I did that for you, Kat, because it's Z in Australia.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, you weren't listening.
I was. I just didn't get it for a minute. But it doesn't say World War Z. It says World War Z.
No, no, it says World War Z, but I did it for you, so you feel a
but
slice
that's the name of
home.
The book. It's a World War III pun. Like, the name of the
World
book
War
is World
Z.
War Z. Like
World War
Z. Oh! Genius. Oh,
Americanization of that. Thanks, cat callers. And... And the 3rd book is, I've chosen this one, and it's the first time we've done this, an anthology. It's Eclipse 4 by Jonathan, edited by Jonathan Strahan, featuring a whole lot of different authors.
Yes, a whole bunch.
Yeah.
Are you in that one?
Are you in that one?
No, I'm not.
No.
Oh, Jonathan. Not good enough.
And me.
And that's it. Thank you very much, Kat, for sitting through this and being part of the...
I tried to take part.
No, you were fantastic.
You have a whole thing.
Did you feel like you were getting in between us?
No. It's hard to be the meat in that sandwich.
I'm leaving that one alone.
Do you have any final words, Kirsten?
No, I think that's it. Thank you to our audience, our live studio audience.
Thank you.
See, I think I'm going to keep that and stick that on the end of every podcast.
Good idea. And that's it for us. Bye-bye.
Thank you. See you next month.
Bye.
That's it then.